And casting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. I'm John Montgomery. Well, coming up Friday night is the first ever Emmy Awards Visual Effects Bake Off. Now, what makes the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences Bake Off a little bit different from the Oscar Awards is that immediately after the presentation by the various panels, the Academy voting members are actually going to vote for the winner. Now, the winner will be announced on Sunday, September 11th, at the Creative Arts Emmy Awards in Los Angeles. Those of you in the States can view a delayed telecast of that the following Saturday, September 17th, on the eTelevision Network. In this week's podcast, we talk to one team from each of the two visual effects categories for this year's Emmys. For Outstanding Special Visual Effects for a Series, we speak with Brian Moylan. Moylan is a visual effects manager of Rainmaker, and Rainmaker were nominated for their work on Atlantis. After that, Mike Seymour talks to the Farscape team, which was nominated for Outstanding Visual Effects for a Miniseries, Movie, or Special. First speaks with Benita Carey, visual effects supervisor for the show, and then two of the lead artists from both Animal Logic and Digital Pictures, Jeremy Howden, who is 3D supervisor at Animal Logic, and DP's animation director, Steve Anderson. But first, Mike talks with Emmy Award winner Steve Scott, a governor of the Special Visual Effects category of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences. Steve was really a driving force behind the Bake Off, as well as a lot of the other improvements in the visual effects and title design categories. Mike?
Thanks for taking some time to talk to us, Steve.
Well, thank you for having me.
And tell us a bit about what we can expect with the Bake Off, and in particular, your role in it.
Well, my role is I'm a working professional. I have worked as a compositor for many years and just made a switch from doing compositing into digital intermediate. I work with eFilm doing digital intermediate and worked a lot on one of the nominees, Life and Death of Peter Sellers. But my role in the Television Academy is I had the great good fortune and honor to be elected by my peers as the governor for the Title Design and Special Visual Effects Peer Group. And so in that capacity, one of the platforms I ran on originally was to try and put together a bake-off, since I was so inspired by the Motion Picture Academy's Visual Effects Bake-Off, and I thought, boy, it really would be great to see the incredible work that's done in television get more notice and have a higher profile. So that's why we've done this, is because we sit in these rooms year after year seeing this amazing work come by, and some of it's very obscure that you might only see on a maybe an obscure cable channel or on a PBS, practically a public service presentation, and it's just amazing. And I've always felt bad that it's just us that's seeing it. Now we're getting unprecedented attention. We're going to have two full-page ads in both Hollywood Reporter and Variety, noting our liaison with Autodesk and providing this bake-off. And the way it'll unfold, basically, is we are going to actually pick the Emmys, the Emmy winners, at this event. So it's a true bake-off. In fact, it's even more important in the selection process than the Academy's bake-off.
I think that's an important point, because it's slightly different from the Oscar bake-off. If people are familiar with the Oscar bake-off, that would be to narrow the field, whereas this is actually about the winner.
Absolutely. It's not a preliminary narrowing. We've already done that. We will be making the final judgments, and the Emmy winner will walk up on stage on the Sunday after the Friday to receive their Emmy. So it's really pretty heady stuff. And I just thought that, and our peer group executive committee thought that would make it so much more interesting and involving for people to actually see how the Emmy selection process unfolds and actually be a part of it in a kind of tangential way. And we've got a great 2K Christie projector in the theater. If you haven't been to the Leonard Goldenson at the Television Academy, I think it's probably the finest theater in Los Angeles as far as the technology and the looks of it. So all in all, it should be a great event. And then, of course, we're going to have our nominee reception, which is an excuse to party and network immediately after this. So I think it's going to be a truly unique experience and just, again, raise the profile of our craft in visual effects and in title design.
So I want to just actually plug the details of it for people that are listening that might be in Los Angeles. First of all, tell me who can attend, and then exactly what the details are of attending.
Well, anyone can attend, and I believe there's information and links on your website, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, we'll have links on our site.
Yes, but actually, I can just tell you, you would go to www.emmys.tv/bulk, B-U-L-K, dash T-D-S-V-E, as in Title Design Special Visual Effects, .html, and that will take you directly to the invitation that has a RSVP link. The important thing to note about this is you do have to RSVP, but it's open to everyone. This is open to the entire creative community. Anyone who shares our interest in visual effects and title design is welcome to come. It's a large theater, and it's our first time this year, so we may have to narrow it down as time goes by, but right now, come on and join the party.
I know that the VES has jumped on board, and they've been sending out stuff. And of those people that can turn up, can anyone vote, or will it just be Academy members?
No, it is. And the thing that we have to keep in mind is it is first and foremost Academy voting experience, and you do have to be a member of the Academy to be able to vote. But, you know, this might inspire some people to want to join the Academy when they see that there are tangible things we're doing. I'd also like to add that this is our third and final voting event of this year. We've already conducted voting in London, in a remote voting, and at Pixar in Northern California. They were kind enough to host us for a remote voting up there. And basically, we're kind of doing the bake-off in remote locations so that people can feel they're getting a little bang for their buck when they pay their membership fees for the Television Academy. Now, I can imagine this happening in Australia, and I can imagine it happening in British Columbia and New York and wherever. We just would have to have somebody involved in those areas that wants to kind of put something together and arrange for a venue. But it's a very, very different year this year in all of those things happening. So,
well, as you know, we completely support you in your efforts. I mean, I think it's a really significant thing. I think being a member of the Academy is a good thing. I know I am. And I really appreciate you taking some time to talk to us. I know you're in the middle of grading a film right now. So thank you very much for taking the time.
Thank you, Mike, and thanks for all your support. You're doing a great service for the community.
One of the nominees this year in Outstanding Special Visual Effects for a Series is the team at Rainmaker for their work on Atlantis. And we have Brian Moylan on the line from Rainmaker to discuss with us some of the work they did on the series. So welcome, Brian. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mike.
So congratulations on the nomination. You must be excited.
Yeah, very excited. It's always very cool to be recognized by your peers. Congratulatory messages from your mother only goes so far. You need to hear it from people in the industry, too.
How big's the team you've got there? And
Well, Rainmaker Visual Effects at the moment is we've grown to about 75 people. We're taking on some new projects right now, so we've grown a little bit just in the last month. And the team specifically for Stargate and Atlantis was a total of about 8 compositors and 8 or 9 CG artists.
So, obviously, with a series, there are a lot of issues that are slightly different from, you know, a one-off project. But also, in this case, you've got a history. You've got a very strong visual history from the other series and also from the film. Did that influence how you approach things?
Well, yeah, there were some things that they absolutely wanted to keep the same, and then there were other things that they wanted to revise and make new. Obviously, the way the puddle interaction works had to be exactly the same, but the gate they wanted a little bit of difference in, and of course, the whole city was a total departure visual effects wise. So all the rules could be broken and rewritten from that respect. So we were able to use that to maximum advantage because we had worked on the other series for so long. We kind of had a feel for how the producers worked and the kind of work they liked, and we were able to implement that into both the ongoing existing material and the new look as well. So it made it quite efficient.
It must have been a bit of a meeting where you first saw the storyboard ideas for having a city break through through the water like that.
Yeah, we laughed at first, and then you kind of go, oh, okay, you're serious, right? And knowing, of course, that it's great to be able to have all the time and a decent budget on a pilot to really go to town, but you know that whatever you do, you need to be able to generate shots on an ongoing basis for the series as well. And this was the first year that they went full HD, so we weren't dealing with
So obviously when you look at a city, one of the things one would normally think about is models, but breaking the water, I mean, water tends to be such a difficult beast to deal with. It doesn't scale very well. It tends to make things look small. And probably was that the reason that you sort of went the path that you did?
Yeah, definitely. We definitely needed to have an in-computer solution for the water and to be able to do it at a several different scales. And luckily for us, in the last couple of years, we've really embraced the idea of using multiple software packages within the same team. So we were able to use both Maya and Lightwave to generate, for example, we used the Lightwave system to do our further away, larger scale water surfaces, and then Maya was much more integral in doing the more detailed water work. And then, of course, it was all enhanced with some particles and some real water elements, especially in the big shot in the pilot where the city comes up. That was, we did a big practical water shoot, dropping a big hunk of concrete into the water, and so there were real elements mixed in as well.
So tell me what the pipeline was on that. I presume it was all prevised, and then, you know, I mean, was it hard to get the city model approved, for example, or was it, I mean, I've seen some really nice concept art on this.
Yeah, the concept art was a good start, but it really, the art department really had their hands full with a whole lot of things. So at some point, we made a departure from the conceptual art right into CG, and we ended up doing quite a bit of design work in CG. That process took quite a while because they were looking at it from the standpoint of not just what looks cool, but actual city design. Where would the parks be? You know, what's the scale of the city? What would the population be? Therefore, what would the core be like? So we were city designers in real practical terms, and that made the approval process take longer because there were more questions to be asked and then ultimately answered. But to answer your question about previs, we also, during this process, we had a three-artist previs team on site for them. But that was more about, especially in the space battle, really choreographing every shot in advance. We had a real primitive model of the city out there to do some shot composition work, but very heavy previs on the space battle.
And so just at a technical level, what was the sort of passes from you were generating stuff in Lightwave and Maya? Were they, I understand you had like Z-depth passes. It was a multi-pass from 3D, and what were you compositing in?
Well, in fact, that's correct. The CG got so heavy that we had to divide it into a lot of layers, and what we ended up doing was getting our senior CG artists to actually work in Digital Fusion to do some almost complete pre-comps for the look of the shot, and then they would actually do some of the final compositing work just because they were so intimate with all the layers and all the different passes. Sometimes if you hand off 12 or 14 passes of CG to a compositor, they might, you know, chuck away half of them because they're not sure what they're for. So it was a great workflow, and I've really been awakened to the fact that it's quite possible to be a really talented CG artist and really have a good handle on compositing as well. So that was our pipeline. It was Lightwave and Maya, and then we've got a lot of licenses of Digital Fusion here. So those products seem to work quite well together.
It's an interesting trend that in having compositing done, especially of CG elements, by the animators that do them. And then obviously there was an approval process. Was that? Can you walk us through that? How you with HD? Whether you were sending stuff to people, or was it done at your place?
We supplied supervision in both cases. Our own supervisor was responsible for the pilot, and then another in-house supervisor was responsible for all the episodes. And in both cases, the artists need to work to the satisfaction of our own supervisor. So we'll take it quite far down the road before the supervisor will then take the shot. Usually they would take it over either on DVD or on tape. Over to the studios where the show is actually produced and present it to the producers, Brad Wright, Robert Cooper, take all the notes, either get approval or take some notes and bring them back and disseminate them to the artists and then revise as required.
And you touched on earlier on the space sequences and the previs for that, because basically you had both space and water stuff to do. Can you walk us through some of the issues in terms of, because there's some really nice lighting that you did in the space sequences, I thought.
Yeah, well, It's interesting on the previous front. A lot of people are under the impression that, you know, you can just get a couple of junior level artists in there and start moving the camera around and moving things around. But in the case of the space battle, we took one of our senior artists who ultimately was the lead animator on that sequence, Dan Mayer, and we actually put him out with the previous team for the better part of a month. And his job was to, using the previs type system, basically choreograph the entire battle sequence. That worked out really well, because what he ended up doing was bringing all the scene files back here and building finals, leading the team and building the finals. So he was completely intimate with what the director was after, all the notes he'd received in choreographing the ships and the camera. So it was a great workflow that way. And when you mentioned the lighting, you know, he was kind of, he knew where he was going to go with that in the final analysis. So having him set up the shots, having all that in one mind was a very efficient way to put it together.
Now, you've obviously got so much experience with large-scale effects episodic work. Are there any things that you do in terms of asset management and reuse of stuff that you could highlight for us?
We're actually in the process of trying to formalize our asset management. We do not have anything in place other than a very elaborate file system, and we're kind of self-managing. So we haven't started using anything like Alien Brain or specific asset management software. But to date, we've been able to manage. And yeah, there is obviously a lot of reuse of the CG props and elements from the shows, because they'll actually reference, you remember the ship we did in season 3 of Stargate? Well, we got to bring that back, and it's now season 8. So here's something we did 6 years ago that we have to pull back from our library, and we're always able to do it. But as we're growing now and working on bigger projects, I can see the need for some sort of formalized asset management system.
So one of the other unusual things about Stargate is its active fan community. From everything I know, they've very well received Atlantis, but it must be funny having a kind of there's a viewing public and I guess the ratings for the show, but there's also a specialist group that is kind of assessing your work.
Yes, that's very true, and every so often someone here will catch a thread and send it around, and it's neat to know that they're looking at it in that kind of detail. There was a large debate going over whether or not there should have been white caps that far out in the ocean, and people were talking about fluid dynamics, and you know, some people thought there should be and there shouldn't be, and it's nice to know your work's getting scrutinized, and I think it's a great thing. It's amazing for the show to have such a huge fan base.
So now, swinging to the Bake Off, you'll be there in LA at the both the Bake Off and at the awards.
I'm afraid I won't actually be there. I'm no longer a hands-on artist on any of the shows. I'm responsible for managing the visual effects department. But we'll be sending 7 of the artists, the lead artists and digital supervisors from the team, down to the awards show. And I believe that John Gadecki, who was our supervisor on the pilot, will be down at the Bake Off.
Because one of the things we've been doing is just promoting how that whole idea of having the Bake Off is a good thing for the community, and I'm sure you'd agree that being able to see each other's work and examine what's been nominated each, you know, in a broader context is healthy for all of the industry.
Oh yeah, I totally agree. And in fact, I am still hoping at the last minute to be able to pull it out to get down there myself. But it is a great thing. It's how knowledge spreads, and the overall quality of the talent pool and the artistry among the artists is grown through these kinds of things. So I really support it. I think it's a fantastic thing.
Well, look, thank you so much for taking time to talk to us, and hopefully we will see you in LA at the Bake Off, and great work on the show. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mike. I appreciate it.
Switching now to Sydney, we have in the category of outstanding special visual effects for a miniseries, movie, or a special, Benita Carey. Now, Benita was the visual effects supervisor for Farscape, which was nominated in this category. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's very exciting. It's exciting for all of us, actually. All probably 80 people or 100 people who worked on it. It's really a very exciting recognition.
So, I wanted to, if I could, just start not on Farscape per se, but just on that role that you occupied as being somebody that had to look at the script, work out what it would take to get the effects done, and then break out and award shots. And I was wondering if we could just discuss for a moment, when you get a script, doesn't have to be specifically Farscape, what you're really looking for and how you go about thinking about breaking it down.
Sure. Well, obviously, when you read a script, and I suppose something that's sci-fi, you know that there's a particular, there will be an angle that is towards visual effects, and there will be clear visual effects shots, and other shows might be different, where you have to use your imagination a bit more. But I guess what I do is I read through the script, and I suppose I approach it not like a director, because I wouldn't ever deign to have their experience, but I try and visualize how a scene might be done. And the minute I start thinking, that's going to be a bit difficult to do in the normal circumstances of live action or to achieve without any enhancement from post, I guess I flag that for myself as a potential visual effects shot. I have been caught out at times where a director in their own planning of an episode has thought of something that you just couldn't possibly think of from the script. But because you start planning post-production so early in pre-production, that usually gets flagged and discussed quite early, and I pick them up. But generally, I'll go through the whole script and try and imagine anything that's not going to be an easy, straightforward live-action shot, and I'll flag all of those and start putting a bloody great big database together.
Now, of course, you weren't with any particular post house because you were the visual effects supervisor responsible for the production with Henson's. So what were you looking for when you were looking around to work out how you'd actually go about handing out the project and breaking down, say, Farscape?
Well, luckily for me, I was working with Andrew Prowse, who was the producer, and he also directed the second unit. And he and I had collaborated on the two series of Farscape prior to that. So we were very much, very like-minded in our approach to choosing a visual effects house. And we didn't necessarily feel the necessity to race back to Animal Logic, who had done the previous three series. And we did speak to a number of people. I guess our real priorities would have been a sense of a real creative drive and a creative interest and a willingness to collaborate with us and be excited with us, and also a willingness to work through on a shot to the point where everyone was happy with it. And that's really quite important for us, that we keep tweaking a shot and working a shot either until the alarm bell has rung and it's too late, or until such time as we all feel that it's the way we want it to be.
And so Farscape presented as the movie or the miniseries some interesting changes from the show, I guess, because the budget was obviously bigger, the time frame was different. And I think you said to me once that you thought that Farscape was really a show that had a lot of story in it and just happened to have enough visual effects in it to keep it as sci-fi. So you must have been sort of having a slightly different perspective on sort of lifting the bar on the work that you're doing in the miniseries over the normal TV series.
Yeah, absolutely. The approach was vastly different. During the series, we had quite a limited budget, and as I did mention to you, the stories had to pretty much hold up themselves with what could be done in the realm of live action, and we enhanced that story with visual effects. The approach with the mini series was far more right. Visual effects is just as big a player, I suppose. And the very first draft of the script that came out for the mini series, the opening sequence read something like, "We open on the biggest space battle that's ever been seen on a big screen or a little screen. Star Wars, eat your heart out." Now, that scene sort of did get thrown out at one stage, but then it sort of was reinvented into another kind of space battle, thankfully, because we would have lost our money completely. But in that one scene, and that's actually what I said the minute I read that, I said, yeah, well, we can't afford to do that, guys. But straight away, that script was flagging the fact that this was a visual effects show, which the series didn't really ever do.
And so it was a fairly collaborative project at many levels, and I certainly remember it as just being a lot of fun. What was sort of the lasting impressions, because obviously a little while now since you actually were starting the project, what was your memory looking back?
Well, there are a few sort of interesting things, I suppose. Having worked with Andrew and collaborated closely with Andrew for the good 2 years before the miniseries, I can say that he's an absolute joy of a person to work with, and he's a lot of fun. He's cynical. He's got a wry humour, and we can always come up with a laugh together. So working with him is just a pleasure, and was as well. He's very patient and has a strong idea of what he likes and doesn't, and luckily I've been able to tap into that. The other thing is that the team of guys who worked on the show, I guess we had a really good mix of people who worked on the show who had worked on the series with a bunch of new people who'd never worked on the series. So we had that lovely mix of the old, faces and the old people we knew and loved well and who knew the show, with the freshness and the enthusiasm and the new ideas of the new people coming through. And it was a lovely mix of, all getting back together again because the series had finished and we thought it was all gone. And a reunion, I guess, a lovely feeling of a sense of a reunion with a whole lot of fresh energy as well. That was great. It was, look, I've got to say, it was hard, and no one would dispute that, I don't think, but we didn't really, most days, I don't know, sorry, we didn't ever have a script, really. And that makes it really, really hard. It makes it really hard when you're trying to plan visual effects, although it wasn't as hard for me as the poor people who had to get makeup, costume, art department, that sort of stuff. I just had to, we were running each day, the call sheet was changing each day, and we didn't know what to expect on any day, and all I had to make sure that we were doing with the live action shoot was covering as many options as I could, so that when it came to post and came to cutting, I would have options that would keep me covered in terms of storytelling. So that was, we were scrambling. It was a real scramble through the shoot, and I guess once we started working out what we were doing, it settled into, just churning shots through and enjoying the company of the people we were working with and collaborating with.
There was some great previews done on. Could you just touch on the previews for a second? Because that was happening during shooting, wasn't it?
It was. I had a guy who I specifically requested come on and do the previews, and he's one of the other guys who's nominated. And he with the help of a couple of other people, but he drove it, did all the previews on all the 3D shots. And he and I have always worked well together and worked very well together on this, and he understands where Andrew and I come from in terms of storytelling quite well. And he was on, I actually decided to take him out and set him up where we were shooting. So he was with us at the shoot. The first time he'd ever been, part of a shoot or even seen a live-action sort of environment like that. So he was involved, very involved with the project from the very start, and that was really good for us. And he would have done probably 6 months solid with the help of another person with him the whole time. So we would have probably done equivalent of about 12 months previous work.
You say he, but you're referring to Brett?
Talking about Brett. who did receive a great deal of help from a guy called Nigel for most of the time, and they were a joy to work with.
And one of the other things that became apparent in the show was the fact that there were different pipelines being used on different parts of the show. Different pipelines were being done, even inside one unit. Did that pose any problems for you? Was that difficult?
It posed less problems in the end, I suppose, than I'd thought at first. And part of choosing the effects house in the end had been the fact that Animal Logic did own so many of the assets already. They had all the assets, and they were built and textured in 3D Studio Max. So we didn't need to reinvent the wheel by going with them. And we went with them for a whole lot of other reasons as well. It wasn't just that. But when we realised that there was just simply too much work for Animal Logic to get done in the time, we knew that we had to go and ask for help from another company. And it was a terrifying and daunting thought because of the fact that most other companies don't use 3D Studio Max, and that we would need to be working with assets that were fully textured and built in 3D Studio Max that would suddenly have to be used in Maya, for instance. And I sort of avoided it as much as possible, thinking it would be a dreadful mess. And in fact, when we got Digital Pictures on board, I found that the companies, even though they used entirely different pipelines, they worked entirely differently. I think you mentioned before that Animal Logic have built up the tradition on Farscape of having the 3D animators actually composite most of their own shots. I guess probably 80% of the 3D shots at Animal Logic were composited by the 3D animator. And Digital Pictures worked a very different way to that. And also we had to combine specific elements into that end work wormhole sequence with the battle. And I know Digital Pictures actually set up all the little ships battling and the whole war zone in the background. And they actually sent layers over to Animal Logic. And Animal Logic was sending layers over to Digital Pictures, and that we were working in different software, different methods, different everything. But I have to say that it came together really incredibly well, and it was a really pleasant surprise that the cooperation was so good, and actually the technology seemed to be able to cope with it.
In fact, on the wormhole, you were cutting almost shot for shot between the two houses, weren't you?
Yeah. It was a sequence that I really didn't want to split up, but it became bigger and bigger as we got into it. The other thing was with that sequence that we really only worked out what the shots were going to be really after the whole thing had been edited, and once we had an idea of where the money was for the whole miniseries and what sort of money was left. And we sort of went for broke. I mean, it was the climax of the show, and we'd had a lot of trouble over the 7 months prior to that working out the geography and the setup of it. So I was left with no option but to actually really split the battle up. And we had a really, you know, good meeting between us and Animal Logic and Digital Pictures to try and work out how to sort of best split up the shots, and we stuck with that plan pretty much. But they do cut, the shots sort of cut right next to each other, and I think you'd be hard pressed to tell which ones came from which house. And actually, now that it's a year ago that we finished this all off, I think I'd probably be hard pressed to know and hard pressed to remember as well.
And one thing I wanted to discuss with you was, in your role, I remember this really distinctly, the sort of one catchphrase that you used to come out with was, "I'll just see how that works in the cut," as opposed to just approving a shot in isolation. You were always worried about how it would fit into the storytelling. And I know that's something that's very important to you. Maybe you could talk about that for a bit?
Yeah, sure. Well, I come from an editing background and a post-production supervision background. So in that sense, even though I'm quite used to concentrating on individual shots, I'm constantly, in my past, I've been aware of the overview and how a sequence works and how a scene works and then how a segment of a show works. And something that is that I've kept really, you know, a lot of focus on with my visual effects work is how a shot is actually working as part of the shots, how it sits with the shots next to it, how it sits within a scene. The storytelling that it's doing, is it delivering to the audience what we need the audience to be told? And I know that sounds extremely simple, but it's really, when you're working with, say, 40 animators and compositors, and they are concentrating on minute detail, it's really, really easy for them to actually lose that kind of more distant view of it, I suppose, and it's something that I always was thinking of, and I actually enjoyed making them aware of it. I don't know whether other people work this way, but in our review sessions, and I always tried to do reviews with the people who are actually working on the shots and the layers, we would always actually cut those the shots in their various stages, whether it was from previs to an early temp to a late attempt to an almost finished. I'd actually cut it into the cut and sit and talk to the compositor or the animator about how it was working as a piece of storytelling, as opposed to how it was working as a piece of art in its own right.
Because it can be hard sometimes, because, of course, if somebody struggles day and night to get a shot looking great, they want to see it on the screen. They want to see it on the screen as long as they possibly can. And yeah, they can't possibly, I guess, in some respects, understand the full arc of what's happening at that point in the story. And there must be sort of almost pressure on you to fight against just having the beautiful shot that lasts too long or tells the wrong part of the story.
Yeah, you're right, and I suppose handling that with the artist who's working on it and trying to bring them round gently, because I fully appreciate the fact that I would often come in and watch shots that someone had been labouring on until 4 o'clock the previous morning, had gone home and had 2 or 3 hours sleep and was in there sitting with me the next morning. And to actually, you know, I always appreciated all their time and effort. But I guess it's just, you know, gentle persuasion and actually letting them know how much I appreciate their time, and hoping that they can also see where I'm coming from in terms of storytelling, because ultimately, you know, I'd like to think of these people, you know, as they become more experienced, to be actually aware of the storytelling that's part of what they do, because, well, I think they're going to get more out of it ultimately as well. They're going to hopefully enjoy it. So I guess I hope my gentle powers of persuasion and bringing that to their attention would be something that ultimately they might appreciate.
I guess it's obviously a personal achievement for you with the nomination, but also it reflects well, I think, on the Australian effects industry. You must be kind of proud of the work that was done, because it was primarily an Australian crew, wasn't it?
Yeah, the crew on Farscape always has been, I think there were about, there were nearly all Australians making the show. There are some English guys in from the Creature Shop and a few Americans. The writers are American. But really, the production crew and the post-production crew, all Australian, always have been. And I'm really, really proud of the fact that we pulled the miniseries off the way we did. In what is really a short period of time, we did over 700 shots. I think it's 720 shots or something like that. And we finished shooting in March, and we delivered in August. And I think, given the fact that we were shooting every day with pretty much without a script, so too much forward planning was a waste of time, I think we pulled off something that was pretty amazing in that time. And the way that the two companies collaborated, and in fact the way that everyone collaborated on it, was a real... it really shows just how mature we are and how well we can cope with that sort of pressure, and really, I think, in the end of the day, really turn out shots that are fantastic.
Well, look, thank you so much for talking to us. Obviously a joy. And needless to say, good luck.
Thank you, you too.
And thanks very much.
No worries.
The lead visual effects house on Farscape was Animalogic, and their 3D supervisor, Jeremy Howard, is on the line now. Jeremy was in charge of the Animalogic 3D team. So you did a lot of work on Farscape at Animalogic. Tell me about the size of the team you had.
We had a crew which started off at about, I think, sort of 5-10 people at the beginning, and then we expanded to just over 30 people, which was quite a large crew. We also, that was generally the size of the 3D crew, and then part of the 2D crew also even crewed up, possibly with another sort of 10 people at the peak. So we actually almost peaked at about 40 at some points.
And the total duration of the project for you guys?
Total duration was about 9 months long. There was a bit of pre-production beforehand, so it may have been a bit longer. There was a really intense bit for about 5 months.
So Farscape for you was an interesting proposition, because it was, you know, halfway between, it wanted to, and I think did in many respects, achieve feature film grade effects, but obviously it was still television. And you guys had had a lot of experience with the TV series. Do you want to discuss some of the differences between this and just the straight episodic television?
I think the main difference with this is that the it's set up as a final delivery, so we could actually bring all the shots up to the same level, opposed to the during the episodic time where you'd actually some of the shots would get a higher level, but they wouldn't be generally consistent. So in this case, if there was one shot, say that was earlier, that didn't quite make the level, we could actually go back and then sort of bring that one up as we had finessed the pipeline or the techniques for those shots through it. And the crew that we have had were quite experienced as well when they were working with the compositing side, because that's generally where the quality gets pushed to the final degree. And that was when we had our 3D artists actually compositing their own shot, so they can actually flip between 3D and 2D much quicker and have far more control. If they needed just an additional mat or how the lighting needed to be tweaked, they could either, okay, I can quickly do that in 2D, or I do need to go back to 3D. So that, I believe that gave us a lot more control and we're able to generate things more quickly.
So tell us about the pipeline. Tell us, you know, what the pipeline was.
Well, it begins from with two 3D artists that were actually the animators. They were setting up all the scenes. We called that blocking or the animatic stage. And they were working out on set when they were actually filming, and this gave them close contact with the director and the VFX supervisor. So as even though the story hadn't completely been finished and the shots hadn't been fully storyboarded or worked out, they were enabled to do it as things changed and they got direct feedback. So there was two people out there on site full time building up all the shots. And as those shots filtered through, a 3D artist who was responsible for effects and lighting and compositing would then take that shot on, bring all the higher resolution props in and begin lighting all the shots. And an interesting part about this is that it wasn't done in such a linear fashion, because ideally if like we were generating the look of a sequence of say 16 shots, you'd have one shot worked out where okay, that's the nice shot that we have and we need to look towards that and that's our guide. But unfortunately in our situation we didn't have the time for that, so we actually had say five or six people starting on one shot, and when we hadn't had the actual look of the sequence approved, we're trying to sort of guide not just one person but five or six artists in a similar direction. And it worked, because some of the actual artists, you'd grab some ideas from what one artist produced and some from what another artist produced. And then all those images, I actually provided a grading sheet or a reference sheet which I would update on a daily basis. And so, for instance, if there was a ring sequence and there's also this wormhole sequence at the end, and even though the shots are very similar because we're within this the same environment, things are actually quite different because there's close-ups of, say, planets, the rings, or there's a close-up of the wormhole, then we jump back, and then there's a distant sequence. So as each of those shots were developed, you could see how the other artists were going as well, so you could see whether you needed to change things on your shot yourself or at a general direction. It also gave them an idea of like, where we were at, and what stage of the project, and what other people were working on as well.
And so this was, tell me what sort of software apps you were using. So the 3D was in...
Okay, the 3D was predominantly with 3D Studio Max. And the reason for that is that's the way that we had produced the series of Farscape beforehand. So all the props and so forth were already ready to go, set up in 3D Studio Max. And then we also had about 20% done with Maya. And that was to utilise other seniors in the crew. crew, so we had more of a stronger and senior crew. And we divided that up. Like it was that we had a new ship that needed to be built, and we divided that up so that that whole ship would be completely done within Maya. And we also tried to just give Maya shots to the Maya people, or individual shots that weren't part of sequence to Maya, opposed to splitting them up with 3DGO Max and Maya. But we actually did have probably about maybe 10 shots where we needed to combine the two. So that was simply just by rendering out the different elements, and then one of the 3D artists would do the final composite of it.
And which renderers were you using in?
We used three renderers. In Maya, we used RenderMan, and that was for one of the new ships, which is the Penetrator. And then we used predominantly V-Ray for all the 3D Studio Max work. And that came in very handy for its... compared to the standalone 3D Studio Max render, it's got true 3D motion blur, so that helped for the ships flying past very quickly through framed. It also helped with anti-aliasing on the spaceships as they go past, because you wouldn't think so, but the nature of the ships flying through frame and small ships or far away ships coming towards frame, to get the anti-aliasing right or the filtering right, actually it takes a bit of work, and it really shows up on your spacecraft if you don't get that right. And V-Ray helped with that. It has some good anti-aliasing features and wouldn't buzz as much as the standalone renderer.
And you said three renderers. What was the third?
The third is the 3D Studio Max standard renderer.
Right.
So we'll just use that for when it was okay, when it would work for the shot, and as it's quite a quick renderer.
And then you said some of your team were compositing their own work. What apps were they using to do the compositing?
We used Digital Fusion, and that's we actually used a few tools, but all the 3D artists who composited their own shots, we used Digital Fusion for that. And then we also, for the 2D crew, there was we used Flame, we used predominantly Henry as well, which is what all the series was done, and we also used Shake as well. We had a crew that came available, so we utilised them as much as possible. So that's why we used so many different applications.
And did you sort of find that most of the 3D stuff was coming out of the render as a sort of finished stuff, or were you doing multi-pass rendering, and if so, what sort of layers and what sort of separation were you getting?
We're definitely doing multi-pass rendering in it. In most cases, you apply a specular pass and a diffuse pass and a mat for the ship, and you would, the one thing that we needed, the reason for dividing things up so much is to try and get as much depth into space as well, and generally in space there's no atmosphere or no depth of field either, and usually no reference points as well, it's just a bunch of stars. So in the scenes we combined atmosphere with those planets with these big rings around it, and then also with the wormhole sequence, and it involves layering things up. Like if you can imagine looking at a mountain range on a slightly hazy day, you can actually see that they slowly get the mountain range behind the other mountain range just slowly disappears off into the atmosphere, and you can clearly see their silhouettes. And we sort of took that approach, and you can layer things up by just generally adding or a bit of gain or a little bit of colour into each ship behind the next ship, or as for the ring sequence, behind one set of rings through to the next set of rings, and it just builds up. It's very subtle, so it might be only sort of 5% or less between each different layer, but all those layers would build up and then actually create this depth within the environment.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for taking time to talk to us today. Have fun when you get to the bake-off and to the Emmys themselves.
Yes, I certainly will, and thank you very much for the interview. It was great to talk to you.
The other production house or post-production house that worked on Farscape was Digital Pictures, and we have an old friend of FX Guide on the line now. It's Steve Anderson. Steve's on a terrible line standing on set somewhere in the middle of nowhere, but he's joining us to discuss his work on Farscape. So let's talk about Farscape. And of course, I'm fairly familiar with some of the things, but tell people that don't know about some of the approaches that you came up with when dealing with some of the problems, especially to do with the space battles.
Well, at DPV, bulk of the work that we were given was rigid body spacecraft animation, specifically for the battles. And the brief for the ship's motion was to fly them like World War II fighter craft, as that would be a familiar style of motion that would give a key of empathy in the viewer. So as animation director, I thought best thing to do then would be to train all the guys to fly planes properly. So out we went and bought a bunch of joysticks and a World War II flight sim and spent the evenings after work flying above the war-torn World War II Europe countryside in our Spitfires and Messerschmitts and carving each other up, learning to fly in formation and learning military tactics, having a hell of a good time, and also learning a hell of a lot about the dynamics of those kind of aircraft. So what we did was record some of that data. We built a similar system in Maya to just drive joystick straight into the motion capture port of Maya, and we were flying planes around in Maya for a bit of fun, but we wound up actually just tying straight into the game to just give that extra little bit of realism for the pilot. And we got some great performances captured, you know, cutting each other up, and nice little twitchy interactive between two humans rather than one animator kind of extrapolating what one guy might be thinking, what the other pilot might be thinking.
So just to be clear on that, you're actually playing the game and recording that information into Maya?
Yep. Well, recording it into a text file and piping that into
Sure.
Maya. That was a hell of a lot of fun and a great way to actually get the job done, because, you know, firing machine guns at each other is something that we tend to do for recreation anyway. So that was a very, very good project to be working on for us. As a result, we were awarded a lot more of the battle sequences because they really liked the way these ships were moving and our particular, I guess, what we brought to it in the form of formation and tactics, yeah.
And so did you automate that process then, or was that, I mean, how much was it the stuff that was actually of the planes, of the, sorry, the spaceships flying, was that just... did you extrapolate it? Did you?
Well, we sort of look at the data and sort of play it back within Maya with the spaceships attached to the nodes that were driven by the captured data, and we just sort of edit it up and take good bits that we liked and work them into shots. Sometimes as a group, we might have a group of ships coming over the shoulder of the camera that was from one particular battle, and another group of ships that are swinging left to right across the viewport from a completely separate battle. So we were sort of capturing small sections, small clusters of ships, and using them as libraries. We also piped that into a larger kind of particle system that would have every single ship would have its own set of motivations and rules for it to fly around and interact, avoid large groups of enemies, be attracted to friendly forces. If there was a large group of friendly forces near a small group of enemy forces, then they would swing in and attack, try and get behind them, respecting sort of forward-facing shields and weakness of engines behind the backs of the craft and such like that. Much like a sort of a massive...
I was going to say, it sounds like a massive agents and in three-dimensional space.
That's right. It's pretty simple code, really. It's just a subsumptive kind of bit of code that I've adapted from... fiddling with robotics and autonomous systems. So layered on top of that autonomy, we would have the motion capture data from the game play that would give us just that little extra bit of realism to the movements of the craft, that sort of interaction to your nearest neighbour. You know, it would be very realistic because it would be the recorded information of an actual pilot.
Now, let me ask you about one of the other things that you worked on, which was the wormhole. Because
Yes.
The wormhole was obviously a pivotal end sequence. And in many respects, did you have a clear idea what that was going to look like in your head when you were at quoting stage?
Well, it was a bit of an evolutionary process. The initial brief was, I wouldn't say contradictory, it was just maybe a little bit confused. And I had a pretty good idea in my mind of what would look good. And so I sort of jumped into that and came up with a very quick solution. You know, as you do, you get sort of 90% of the way very quickly and then spend the rest of your time bleeding for the last 10%. But we hit on a look that the director liked pretty quickly. I mean, it was only just a matter of a weekend fiddling on my workstation at home, and came up with a kind of a was very procedural, but had a lot of layers going on based on both fluid and particle effects driving each other, and that I guess was the foundation of it. Then we had to come up with a solution for it to be actually growing from shot to shot. The wormhole was supposed to be doubling in size at discrete intervals in time, giving it an exponential growth in mass and destructive power. So we had to come up with a solution that would also show a pulse of energy and a doubling of mass and power, not in a linear fashion, but in actual discrete steps. So that was something quite different that we had to come up with that really drove the look of the wormhole even further. Yeah.
So the pipeline that we had on that was, do you want to walk us through the pipeline of 3D and 2D compositing apps?
Well, it was very collaborative. It's really refreshing working with highly skilled 2D operators that actually understand 3D space, and we wound up having pretty much a set of passes rendered out of 3D with an orthographic view that were then taken into 2D and distorted and warped into a space that worked within the shot. So that way we were rendering extremely high-res text passes that could be warped and scaled and placed into the shot that would allow for a very fast revision as the brief was slowly evolving and we were getting a better idea of what it had to look like. That meant a lot less rendering for 3D and a lot more flexibility in the composition.
Yeah, I think we were working with 1K and higher res textures, and then obviously the show was deliverable at video res.
Mm.
And your 3D pipe?
Well, we had all of the assets from the first series were done in Alias Wavefront at Gunn and McLennan's, which of course we owned Digital Pictures after buying them. So we were rewarded a lot of the shots that involved very close-up camera moves to the, especially the Moya hero ship, since we had actually the original and the highest quality model and textured model of the Moya ship. So that was the simple conversion from Alias to Maya of those assets. But, of course, in the series that Analogic had done, a lot of the other ships that had been introduced or evolved along the way were all 3D Studio Max assets. So we had to either look at converting them into our pipeline, because all of our people were Maya, or what we wound up doing was animating in Maya and just simply using FBX to transfer all of the animation data from the sort of low-res polys that we'd used for the previous. We just take the animation data, camera data, slide it into Max, light it, and render it from there. So very, very short learning curve for our Maya guys to get up to speed in Max.
And do you have a favourite shot from the series?
Yeah, the take five as Moya rolls herself belly up and tucks down through the broken destroyer of the bad guys that's all cut and burning and down through into the atmosphere being chased by a couple of fighter craft. I love that shot. Quite dynamic, quite pretty.
Nice shot. I liked Moya breaking the water and flying up, and on that shot it was it Andrew Jackson that went and shot actual surf to use as sprites?
Yeah, big thing. I'm really strong on using sprites in my particle work. I think it's such a wonderful way of filling the pixels, getting photographic detail into a scene, but still having the control of the 3D dynamic system. So, Andrew went out and he just stuck a camera on a tripod and filmed some nice splashes. We isolated those, stabilized them into a square plate that we then stuck onto some sprites. That looked absolutely fantastic. Of course, they needed support from other layers. We wound up having probably about 16, I think, was it, layers or so?
Yeah, or even, I think it was like 20 in the end in that breaking the water shot.
That's quite likely. But, I think the result was great. The water surface, of course, is just a Maya fluid water surface shader that was tweaked around to match and pick up the highlights of the matte painting for the sky. We
just weren't allowed to have the lens flares we wanted as she broke the sunset.
The little chromatic aberrations in the sky, in the mist.
Yes.
Wound up being wound back a little further than we liked as well, didn't they? But you can't have everything. There's always compromise.
Still, as you say, it was a really good collaborative show.
Yeah, I feel so. Yeah, it was a very tight deadline when we had a lot of extra work given to us late in the day. It was a long haul for everybody at DP. It was a big burst, and everybody gave their bloody all. It was a wonderful project and a wonderful team to be working with.
So have fun at the Emmys. See you in LA.
Yeah.
And thanks for taking time to talk to us.
Cheers, mate. Thank you very much.
So I just want to thank everybody that took time to talk to us today. Hopefully we can see you at the Bake Off. Coming up in podcasts still to come, we have an interview with the guys on The Big Ad, which is one of the big viral campaigns that's been going around. We're also speaking to the guys at 55mm and Digital Film Tools about some plugins, as well as some stuff to do with Smoke and some stuff to do with Apple, Shake, Motion. There's some really good stuff coming up in the podcast, so thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2005 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.